got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Before we get into this episode, I want to go over some pretty big changes we've made to the podcast recently. First and foremost, I want to introduce my new co-host, Dr. Kevin Folta. Now, most of you probably know a little bit about Kevin, but for people that don't know about your work and what you do, Dr. Folta, just give us a brief introduction.
Yeah, hi. Well, my name's Kevin Folta. I'm a professor and also a podcast host. And my work is mostly on how light affects plant biology, and also do a lot of work using genomics tools to understand genes associated with flavor. But really, my passion is sharing science with the public, both my research and research of others, and mostly training scientists and farmers and other folks who aren't classically trained on how to talk about science on how to do it better. And I think it's a great time for us to be communicating science because the public is excited by the stories we're telling. So thank you very much for having me along.
Hey, I'm always happy to chat, Kevin. So for those of you that have listened to the show before, you know that typically I sit down one-on-one with an expert guest and we talk about some pressing issue in biotechnology. And so loosely, we're going to keep that format since Kevin's a geneticist and he's very familiar with the topics we're going to be covering. But instead of covering just one topic, we're going to cover three or four major stories that are in the news. And the idea is to get a broader understanding of what's going on in this field of research, but then to also dive past the headlines a little bit and try to pull the significance of these stories out so you guys walk away a little bit more informed about what's going on out there. So with that introduction out of the way, Kevin, let's talk about this first story, which is about the possible relationship between alcohol consumption and brain size. So tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so you always heard about the association, like, you know, your parents or anybody else would tell you, hey, don't drink, it's going to shrink your brain, right? You've heard this, right?
Oh, yeah. as a teenager, right? Mom said, don't drink.
Yeah, I heard it for years, too, and I always thought, well, you know, as long as I keep putting information in and growing it at a proportional rate, you know, but seriously, it is seriously a problem that, you know, alcohol does cause a change in brains and does cause neurological issues. And so it's important to understand those associations. And this was kind of a chicken or egg question that was pursued by someone named David Berenger. He's wrote this in Massive Science this week. And he's a PhD student in Pittsburgh who asked the question, does alcohol cause the shrinkage of the brain, or is the shrinkage of the brain causing alcohol consumption? And so that's how he took on.
Okay, so what did they find? Because he did multiple experiments, and I think the first one that's pretty interesting that we should dive into is this idea of a twin study to try to separate out these effects. So tell us a little bit about twin studies in general, and then what exactly did they do?
Well, studies on twins have been used for a long time because you have two genetically equal, you know, generally people. So if you're talking about, you know, identical twins, so now you can really test the effects of external influences on a given process because you're dealing with a common genetic background. And that's extremely powerful. So what they did here was look at twins where one twin had a more consumption of alcohol than the other. And then they started to look at the brain size of those two twins to see if they were any different. So the results of those studies showed that the brains were exactly the same, even though one of them was moderately consuming alcohol. So that meant at those moderate levels explored, the alcohol use did not change the brain size.
Now, that wasn't the only experiment they did. They actually went on and did what good scientists are supposed to do, and they tried to validate their results. So tell us about this next experiment they did.
Well, the big problem is it's very difficult to do this experiment because you can't ethically, you know, give one group gin and tonics, you know, margaritas, and then tell the other one, you know, here's some, you know, placebo alcohol, right? Because you know the difference. There's a physical effect. You know that you're under the influence. So it would make that test very, very difficult. So how do you do this? What they did was they took children and adolescents who never had any alcohol history and measured the different aspects of their brain. And what they found is that when you followed them through their lives, through college and into early adulthood, that the ones that consumed alcohol had a smaller part of the brain called the middle frontal gyrus. And the middle frontal gyrus was smaller when they were kids, and that associated with alcohol use. So here you're looking at the chicken and the egg question and really seeing that alcohol may not be causing the brain shrinkage, at least with respect to this feature of the brain, but this feature of the brain may be an indicator of a predisposition to alcohol use. And so that was the real breakthrough of this particular study.
Okay, so one important takeaway might be that just because you see an association, that doesn't mean that one thing is causing the other. And I know we hear about that all the time. In the mainstream press, we'll see a story that says, you know, X preceded Y, therefore X caused Y. And so is this a classic example of that scenario, Kevin?
It really is. This is a great example of how it actually was a little bit surprising. It wasn't that alcohol was causing the brain to shrink, but that the smaller part of the brain was associated with alcohol use. And this is really important because going forward, you can start to look at what that part of the brain may do functionally, or what genes are expressed in that part of the brain, or what that part of the brain may allow researchers to understand as maybe a physical structural part of the brain that is connected with alcohol use.
So sounds like what we have here is a really well-conducted study, but it's limited and we can't really draw any major conclusions just yet. We have to keep doing the work, or rather these researchers have to keep doing the work in order to say definitively what the relationship between alcohol consumption and brain size is. Is that a fair assessment, Kevin?
I think that's fair, but you know, it's the old story. If you want to find a needle in the haystack, you really have to first find a haystack. And these folks have identified a part of the brain which associates with this kind of behavior. So it's a good starting point.
Very interesting. All right. Well, with that wrapped up, let's move on to our next story. And this one, I have to be honest, was both fascinating and just absolutely terrifying at the same time. And of course, what I'm talking about is this story in MIT Technology Review about synthetic coronavirus. And so I'm sure everyone's at least heard about this, right? It's been in the headlines. I think it's something like 2,700 people have been sickened by this virus at this point, and it's still spreading.
Yeah, you're looking probably at it getting close to 100,000 now, and with 2,700 to 3,000 deaths. So it's a much wider spread than what people anticipated. And by the time this goes live, the data will already be stale. I mean, it's moving fast.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for that correction. Okay. So it's still spreading. And so based on this article, what I'm seeing is that the way scientists are trying to tackle this is actually make a synthetic version of the virus from customized genes that you can get from certain labs around the United States. And the idea is that you can manipulate the DNA and try to figure out either a treatment for it or figure out some way to disable the virus. Is that what they're trying to do?
Well, as a DNA scientist, this is something that has blown me away for years, that this is so cool that you can do this. And this is a story that was from Antonio Regalado, who works with MIT Technology Review, and he does outstanding stories. And this is a really cool one. You know, as a scientist who works with DNA, I can go online and put a DNA sequence onto a website, and I can put in my Visa number, my credit card number, and push send. And then sometime tomorrow afternoon, a FedEx guy shows up with an envelope with a test tube inside with the custom DNA I just ordered. And it costs about, a tube of DNA that might have, a rather short sequence might cost $5. It's amazingly cheap. It's so cool. And so what you do when you have a new viral outbreak and you can't get access to the virus, and that's the real question here. So the Chinese government has isolated the coronavirus. They've sequenced the coronavirus, made that information public, which is great, but they have not released the virus for study. So if you're a researcher who wants to work on it, how do you get it?
Well, you'd have to make it, right? That's essentially what they're trying to do. So if I can ask you this, how close is the synthetic version that they're making how close is it to the real thing? Is it still useful enough that you could maybe come up with a treatment for this infection?
Well, what it is it's an exact clone that was made synthetically. So what it allows you to do, if you go online, you can find the source of the corona, or you can find the sequence of the coronavirus and all of its little variants, and you can come up with a consensus sequence. And that's exactly what Ralph Barrick did at UNC, University of North Carolina. They took the coronavirus sequence and then just ordered the synthetic version. And then you can take the synthetic version of that virus. You can now introduce that to cells, and it will assemble the virus around it. It actually will use that genetic information to make the virus itself. That's how viruses work. They inject their genetic information and then hijack the cell to produce the stuff around it that allows it to survive as a virus. And so these folks have just circumvented that process of having to have the virus itself and synthesize their own.
Yeah, this is fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about what you can do with this. I've already mentioned that you could possibly come up with a cure or at least a treatment for this. But there's all kinds of applications. So a vaccine is one of them. I know that they're using these synthetic viruses to try to better diagnose people who might have been infected. So tell us a little bit about what they're trying to get out of these kinds of experiments where you're building viruses in the lab.
Well, if you know the parts of a virus and the viral sequences, you can start to understand the proteins that are encoded within them. So the genetic material is just a blueprint that provides the information to make proteins that give the virus its form and function. And so when you can reconstruct those proteins, it now allows you a basis for creating diagnostic tests, maybe vaccines, maybe any other kind of product that would require, that could be targeted specifically at the coronavirus. So certain drugs maybe for this specific virus. So that's the beauty of this. And the companies that have been making the DNA have been inundated with requests around the coronavirus. This 2019, as they're calling it now, the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Now, I mentioned that the story was fascinating and terrifying. And what's terrifying, and they cover this, or he covers this in the article, is that there is a real risk of bioterrorism. So talk to us a little bit about how the companies that produce this DNA, how are they trying to prevent such an outcome? Because people have indeed synthesized viruses that are deadly, you know. So how do we stop that, you know, moving forward?
Well, one of the scariest ones in my recollection was that the Soviet Union, back in the old Soviet Union days, had created a virus that had an anti-myelin signature to it. So you could introduce this and it would attack the human nervous system. I mean, you could create viruses that would be used as weapons in bioterrorism. But here you would have a company that online through a website would allow you to essentially remake smallpox. So a virus which has been gone for ages, or, you know, the plague or whatever, you could come up with, well, plague is bacterial, but you could come up with any kind of viral sequence that maybe never existed, or maybe new variants. You know, viruses mutate, and they do this in the wild from person to person. You can, for research, kind of pre-mutate that virus and see how it works. Or if you had maybe malevolent intent, you could mutate the virus to identify variants that were potentially even more dangerous, more deadly, more infective, or more problematic. So this is the problem, is that these companies could be theoretically hijacked by a terrorist to make a weapon that could be used against people.
Okay, so that's the horrifying part. Now, the more, I guess, calming part that kind of eases my fear is that these companies are actually working together. I believe they're all part of a trade organization. And one of the things they do is they have a list of all the viruses that they consider high risk. And so they're carefully monitoring who's buying what and how much and so on and so forth. And then through that process, you can tell if there's a risk, if you're selling DNA to someone who might have malevolent intentions. So that's good. And I also believe, I don't know if it's the same scientist, but one of the guys that runs one of the companies said he just won't make the full virus. He'll send, you know, different parts of DNA, different segments, but he won't sell the whole thing. So that is probably a smart thing, you know, a good precautionary option. So what do you think about that? Should we really be concerned about bioterrorism in this case?
Well, the companies do have some standards and they do watch for these sequences. It's easy when they come in to run them through a filter and see if they match anything potentially dangerous. That's great. But here's a couple of caveats. You mentioned that they'll only synthesize part of a virus. Well, DNA is like molecular Legos. We know that already. And that you can cut and paste things together. So giving people the parts through five different companies that you assemble, you know, in a rather rudimentary molecular biology laboratory kind of gets around that process. The other thing, too, though, is that DNA synthesizers aren't that expensive. And you could probably do this yourself at some level. It doesn't require massive expertise to do, but it's getting more and more common to be able to synthesize long runs of DNA or RNA, the other genetic material, for very, very inexpensive. And so this is something that needs to be on the radar and something that I'm sure that our military and other oversight agencies are watching because it is a legitimate threat.
Yeah, and I actually think it was a preliminary thing, but I believe it was the NIH or some federal agency actually shut down one of these labs temporarily that was building DNA. And then once they vetted them and said, okay, you guys are just doing research, everything's above board, then they were allowed to continue working. But just it goes to show that there are people looking over this, yes?
Well, yeah, that's Barrick's lab at University of North Carolina. He actually was looking at the virus he was looking at viruses in the past, different viruses, and then pre-mutating them. So introducing changes and ordering that DNA for the changes in the virus, and then reintroducing them to things like mice to look at how those changes in sequence affected issues of, say, virulence or lytic nature of the virus or whatever you're trying to measure in the virus. And so this was a really important tool for them to use, yet NIH really took a step back and wanted to evaluate, is this what we want to be funding because of the potential downside? But ultimately, the benefits outweigh the risks. And so this is just something that we're going to have to be careful with, but we can't impede.
Yeah, very good. And one thing I'll add just in wrapping up is that I think this is a great example of where a little bit of knowledge of genetics really ties in with what's going on in the world. Because I remember being younger, and then I've heard a lot of people say this throughout life, why do I have to take a science class? This is just, this is theoretical. I'm bored. I want to go do something else. But I think this is a real great example of, oh, I understand this. And now I'm a little more informed. I know what to do. Maybe I don't have to panic now. So on and so forth. So I think this is just a great reason, why you should learn a little bit of science so you can decipher what's going on in the headlines.
Yeah, you should start a podcast and then tell people about these things.
You know what? Let me go Google podcasting and I'm going to see how that. All right. Well, let's jump over to the other side of the world and talk a little bit about micronutrient deficiencies. And I know on Talking Biotech, you've discussed golden rice a ton. You've talked about the importance of genetically engineered crops to improve the nutrition of people all over the world. So let's talk about this story that was published in your active. And I'll let you introduce it. And then I want to go over a couple of things that were just really shocking to me. So what's the case that they're making in this article?
Well, this article comes from A.J. Cole, who is a leader of a team that's looking using genomics and bioinformatics, so DNA-based tools, at IRRI, so the International Institute of Rice Research. I transposed those letters, but you get the idea. And Joanna DuPont Inglis, she's the Secretary General of Europa Bio. That's an industry group there. And they wrote this article really lamenting the slow pace of progress in the area of biofortification. Now, I'll start out with something that wasn't in the article, is that, let's start talking about the problem, is that there are a huge number of people, like 2 billion, billion with a B, worldwide that suffer from micronutrient deficiencies. And this is iron, zinc, vitamin A, micronutrient deficiencies that really manifest as susceptibility to other diseases that ultimately can lead to death. So very, very small deficiency, yet tremendous problem. So that's where we start. So scientists have sought to solve this problem, but with biofortification. that can you take the world food staples, things like rice, potatoes, corn, things, cassava, things that don't have a lot of nutrition, and maybe boost the nutrition in those crops. And they've been doing that for some time now. So do you remember that Time article about 20 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. What was it? This rice could save 1 million kids a year or something. I believe that was the headline.
Yeah, it was a big picture of Ingo Patricus on the cover, yeah. And talking about this rice that he had invented, Peter Beyer and other folks, to resolve this problem. And it was an amazing effort 20 years ago now that this existed. And it wasn't perfect, and it's gone through some iterations, and they didn't talk about that much in the article. But the basic idea was, in the article, was alarming people to the fact that we have a solution that has not been implemented. And it really raises the ethical questions of, you know, why is there so much regulation? Why is there so much opposition? And really, that is mostly where their article addressed.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, absolutely. But just one statistic that they put in here that was just truly shocking to me is they said that the annual cost worldwide for these micronutrient deficiencies you're talking about is $3.5 trillion. And it sounds like that's in terms of like lost productivity and medical treatment for people that are sick, everything related to this malnutrition issue. And to give some scale, I believe the U.S. economy is worth about $20 trillion. And so, I mean, we're talking about a massive, massive cost. And the point is not the money, of course. The point is that this is all the suffering. You know, if you have to put a dollar amount on it, this is a lot of pain and suffering and even death for a lot of these kids. And so, you know, it's hard when you're in the United States or you're in Europe and you're full and you're wealthy and, you know, you don't see what's going on. And so to look at a figure like that and go, wow, that's massive, you know? So I think that might be something useful for people to know, or if someone asks you a question about that, you know, that might be something to go, hey, this is a huge problem. You know, what do you think about that, Kevin?
Well, it's a huge problem, but it's a problem that may be somewhat easily correctable. And they've shown in the last decade that you can biofortify crops. So you can, not using genetic engineering, but by using traditional breeding, they've been able to bring the genes from the orange sweet potato, the one, you know, Thanksgiving one that we have, and introduce that to the white sweet potato that they eat in Africa on the continent. And now you're able to give the beta carotene, the stuff that's in carrots, the orange pigment that gets split into vitamin A or gets split into provitamin A. The beta carotene is a cool molecule. It's kind of a symmetrical molecule. You cleave it down the middle once it's in the body. And that serves as vitamin A, which is used in a number of different processes, such as vision, other physiological processes, including immune response. And so it does work. You can do it. Only with biotech, you can do it faster. And you can take genes from bacteria or plants that make beta carotene and introduce them to things like rice or cassava or things that don't make beta carotene. And it could theoretically provide 50% of the needed beta carotene to people who are in this deficiency. So that's a big step.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the points they mentioned, and the significant thing is that you're putting it in food that they have access to already, because I know that vitamin supplementation is a big thing. And then you get people here, they go, oh, well, we have plenty of food. We'll just send them food. But, you know, for a number of practical reasons, that doesn't always make sense. But the thing here is that they have access to rice, and it's a big part of their income goes to just feeding themselves.
And well, so that's very true.
Yeah. So if you can enhance the nutrition of the food they're already consuming, you know, that's a big step up. And I think the Philippines is close to approving golden rice. It's got like one or two more steps, and then farmers can actually start cultivating it. Is that the case?
Yeah, the Philippines is extremely close, and Bangladesh as well. Philippines may even have it out in 2020 and distributed this year. But just to touch on something you said in that last bit, that so many people who are in wealthy nations say, you know, hey, just let them grow carrots, let them grow rutabagas and spinach. They'll love it. They'll be just fine. And what's so funny is that the people who say those things, because they're against the idea of using biotechnology, are also the folks who typically would be very sensitive to socially appropriating or socially introducing or forcing our expectations on them. you know, let's have people choose the foods that they eat culturally, the ones that are important for their society, the ones they know how to grow, that have been adapted to their regions. And let's just use the modern power of genetics to make them a little better. And I think that's such a better solution.
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating point that I hadn't given much thought to, but you don't want to disrupt their way of life. And I think that's interesting, too, because another one of the common critiques is that, you know, these big biotech firms like Monsanto and Bayer, they're going into the third world and they're using these crops as a Trojan horse, quote unquote, to, you know, to get people hooked on their seeds. And you and I know that's not quite the reality of the situation. But I think that's an interesting point. If anything, we're trying to use, not us, but these researchers, they're trying to use biotechnology to just improve the lives of these people and not disrupt the way that they live and that the way that their society functions. So thank you for mentioning that. Very interesting.
That's a good point. And the fact that these technologies ultimately are to be given away. That's the other side of this. No one's profiting. In fact, a lot of folks are losing tons of money on the production of these, which is great because it's for a very critical humanitarian need. And folks at Erie and other places have made great sacrifices to try to advance this technology and ensure it can get to the people that need it. So hopefully we'll see it this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, moving on to another humanitarian issue, and I mean, this is a real big issue, and people may have heard of these swarms of locusts in East Africa, and I believe they're in the Middle East as well now, but they're swarming all over these countries, and they're destroying crops, and they're actually creating a real serious hunger crisis and the potential for a food shortage because they're destroying everything. So tell us a little bit about this, Kevin. What's the problem, and what's the scale of it?
Well, let's start with scale. These are swarms of locusts. Ravenously hungry insects that breed like crazy that are, the article says, the original article, 40 by 60 kilometers in size. So think about that for a minute. I mean, this is covering, you know, I don't know how big Rhode Island is, but this is a gigantic swarm of locusts. So 40 by 60 kilometers. And then to think that 1 square kilometer of these insects eats about 35,000 people's worth of food a day. So this 1 kilometer will eat 35,000, what the amount of food that 35,000 people would eat. And then there's these swarms that are just massively bigger than that. So you can imagine the huge problem that's happening here. And they've been descending in areas of the Middle East and the Horn of Africa. So the countries like Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, the folks that are really just getting on their feet in so many ways with modern agriculture, and now they have these swarms of locusts that they just can't control.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I believe they can fly 150 miles a day. This is just like a super bug almost. You know, it's like, where did this thing come from? This is ridiculous. So now the primary way that you would prevent something like this, or at least get it under control, is that you would spray pesticides that take these swarms out, right? And so what's the situation? Why are these countries not just applying these pesticides to wrap up this issue, Kevin?
Well, the major pesticide they use for this, a major insecticide, is phenethylamine. And phenethylamine is an organophosphate. So it's one of these old school neurological agents that, you know, it has some risk. It has some safety profile you need to respect, but it's extremely cheap and extremely effective on killing insects. And so it's been a huge plus to be able to use aerial spraying to take out these bugs. The problem is, for instance, Kenya has 5 aerial spray planes and a very limited budget to be able to do this. So they've received some funds who did they receive funds from? The UN. They received funds from the UN, FAO, and this is finally looking like an easy way that they'll finally be able to get on top of the problem.
All right. Now, again, with the golden rice issue, we saw this issue of activists getting involved and trying to hold up the approval process. And on this issue, we're seeing the same thing where you have European-based environmental activist groups that don't like pesticides generally, who are actively trying to keep the necessary chemicals out of Kenya and out of these other countries, even though they know what's at stake here. So tell us a little bit about that part of the issue.
Yeah, this is the part that's heartbreaking. And again, you go back to those well-meaning folks who, you know, ultimately, I think they're doing the right thing. And, you know, they think that Kenyan farmers should be working with a more agroecological bend and doing everything organically. You know, and I just don't understand. Well, I understand where they're coming from and why they think they can do this. But the problem is that we got a crisis right now. And they're going in and working with the government of Kenya and trying to convince them to ban 200 different kinds of pesticides from these applications, one of which is the one that's being used to control these locusts. And these are groups that are funded from Germany, like the German Green Party, Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, all kinds of other NGOs throughout Europe, which are now imposing their interests on really poor countries in Africa as they attempt to get on top of this insurmountable problem. And it's something that, again, you know, just keeps me awake at night. When they don't have the insecticides, do you know how they're solving the insect problems, how the farmers in Kenya are solving the problem?
Well, I saw several examples, and they were all just mind-blowing. So I believe they're burning tires, and they're shouting, and they're blowing whistles.
Hey, insect, you know, get out of here.
It's like this. I would irritate my siblings that way when I was a kid. Not the tire burning, but everything else. You know, like, this is not how you treat insect infestation. This you know, and I'm not making fun of those people. They're doing what they have to. But we have so much more effective tools available. And they're just, they either can't afford them or they're not being allowed to use them. And I just find the latter especially very, very irritating. And, you know, it really, as you said, it's very, very disappointing. So.
Well, the thing on this from my perspective is you know, and it's easy to make fun of it. It's easy to say, well, they're burning tires and yelling and blowing whistles to get the insects away. But it shows the desperation that when you're a farmer and this is your small plot, your 5 acres, and this is what you got. And now a swarm of insects descends on it and starts destroying it overnight. What do you got? You know, and you know, if you can burn some tires and try to get the smoke to scare them or run out and have the, you know, one farmer I once talked to in Africa said, well, what we do to control insects is we have the children stay home from school, pick them off the plants and take them somewhere else. This is the kind of desperation you have that is normal everyday life so you can eat. And this means kids stay out of school. It means farmers lose their livelihoods. And when you don't have food, you turn to getting it some other way, which can include theft or prostitution. And those are the realities that we find when, you know, wonderful, wonderful, sweet people need to provide for their families and have their crops taken by natural forces. It turns people to other kinds of ways to get food. And this is the tragedy of this, is that now the technologies that are there and are accessible and are being able to control it are now the ones that wealthy Europeans wish to ban.
Yeah. Well, and one other point, and this, I've read this in the article, and this is from a story in European Scientists, by the way, which we will link to on the page for this episode for Biotech Facts and Fallacies. But these activist groups, they're trying to ban these 200 insecticides, but one of the chemicals they're trying to exempt is copper, which is used as a fungicide in organic farming. And so this really just struck me as cynical, because they're talking about how all these synthetic chemicals are dangerous, but copper, I believe, is a carcinogen, and it builds up in the soil, and it's very toxic to everything. and so if they were really concerned about you know, toxicity of these chemicals, they would be banning this too, but they're not. So what's your take on that?
Well, copper is natural, so it's safe, right? And so it's that old naturalistic fallacy where, because it comes out of the earth, it must be okay, and Mother Earth would never do anything to hurt you, you know, outside of, you know, the black death cab mushroom and arsenic and all the other goodies that we have. It is kind of a hypocritical issue, because we shouldn't be separating chemistries based on if they are natural or synthetic. We should be separating chemistries on what are their risks, what are their benefits, what are the thresholds we need to be careful of, how do they impact the environment, and how do they affect human health, and make our decisions based upon those criteria, because that's the way we should be determining what insecticide or what agent to use, and we should be rotating them, using them in concert with each other and other integrated pest management strategies. That's how we solve the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And the final takeaway for me, and I'll let you add to this after, but the real significant point for me is that this really illustrates why pesticides are necessary in agriculture. And I mean, and this is a very extreme example where you're talking about people are just literally trying to save their farms from destruction. But on a smaller scale, farmers deal with this every day. So I know in some of these countries, they're struggling with fall armyworm right now, which is another pest that they're trying to control. But farmers in the United States and Canada and literally all over the world, they need agrochemicals to, you know, keep bugs from eating the stuff that we want to eat. So obviously we don't want to use toxic chemicals and we want to be as sustainable as possible. And it's getting better year over year. But nonetheless, these have an important role in food production. What would you say about that, Kevin?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. The chemistries are getting better. They're getting more discreet. They're getting more specific. We are getting better at detecting them and better at detecting their effects on non-targets. And we're learning and we're getting better all the time. And it's not perfect, but it's an important tool that's being used in food production. And when we start to look at things like chemistry and we start to use chemistry as part of an integrated plan with being careful of when we plant, the other beneficial insects that can be potentially harmed, the use of beneficials on purpose to control certain insects. There's so many aspects to being able to control insects that really do fold in some of the principles of agroecology and the practices on organic farms. That's nobody's knocking that stuff other than it isn't a sole solution for everybody. And it has to be part of a wider spectrum of really good choices that are informed by science and good evidence.
All right. Well, that sounds like a pretty solid place to stop for me. What do you think, Kevin? Anything else you want to add about any of the stories we covered?
No, I think that's perfect. I think it's going to come out okay.
Yep. Fingers crossed, God willing, all that, but I'm feeling pretty good. So thank you guys again for joining us here on the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm Cameron English, and my new co-host, of course, is the always brilliant Dr. Kevin Folta. And we will see you guys next week. Thank you so much for joining us.